If you don't own assets to keep pace with inflation, for the last 24 years, you're basically getting poorer every year.
Peter Smith, co-founder and CEO of Blockchain.com, a $14 billion global crypto company with over 90 million users and $1.5 trillion transacted. Why are digital currencies so important?
The first is that
the price of Bitcoin is at another all-time high.
$89,000.
What was the darkest moment building Blockchain.com?
The first crash. You need to be attached to the process of building this company, or like just stop, because you can't control the outcome.
Peter is a pioneer in the financial technology space on a mission to help humanity create economic freedom.
If I need to make money again, I think the thing that I would tell myself is like, go find the three smartest people you know that haven't made money yet and figure out something to do with them.
Do you foresee any intuitive black swans you could see happening to take out Bitcoin? What do you perceive as the current state of the economy? Like, what is important for people to understand right now?
I think there's two larger trends that are going on right now that people really need to kind of understand. Well, the first is that we're in a largely inflationary environment. Regardless of where we get nominal inflation down to, however sort of the government's measuring it right now, if you look at the last 20 years, we are in a persistent state of asset inflation, which means that if you don't own assets that keep pace with inflation, for the last 24 years, you're basically getting poorer every year. And this is a hidden tax on people who have assets. If you don't have assets, so for example, if you have debt, it actually is making you more wealthy. And the average American has far more debt than they have assets. And so one of the things that we don't talk about enough in our country is that we do have relatively few people that own assets in America as a percentage. We have a lot of people who have a lot of debt, specifically in the form of mortgages. And if you've had a mortgage for the last 20 years, you've really had a great deal. This is partly why the real estate market is what it is, and it's almost impossible for people to buy new homes today. It's because people have had very cheap leverage, they've had inflationary assets, and they've had the value of money going down. For the most part, if you have more debt than equity, this regime for the last 20 years has been really great for you. But if you have assets and you're not in assets that keep pace with inflation, it's been really, really negative for you. The second thing that people have to understand is that we're still in a time of immense transition. We spent a lot of time talking about the internet and how the internet would change life maybe 10, 15 years ago. And the reality was, when we were having those discussions, the internet wasn't really changing anyone's life. Like, everybody's lives was 15 years ago is pretty much functioning the same way it had 15 years prior. But in the next 15 years, very slowly, the way that we live our lives has completely changed. And you can see this in spending trends and consumption spend, even in where people live and in the real estate market underneath that. The same thing is going to happen with AI. We're going to spend a ton of time talking about AI and predictive models for the next 2 or 3 years. And then we're all going to get bored of it. We're going to stop talking about it. And then over the next 10 years after that, it's going to fundamentally change the way everybody lives and works and productivity. But these two things, and it's basically powered by cheap compute and cheap memory, are going to fundamentally change the entire way humans live in a 20 to 30 year period, which is long enough that the average human won't really feel it occurring, because we have to feel things occur very suddenly psychologically. But it's short enough that it's going to be very hard for a society to adapt to all the changes. And you're seeing that already, broad variety of societal impacts already of sort of the whole impact of technology and freely available internet. That sort of change with AI and technology is going to vastly impact the labor market and productivity in the economy. It's most likely going to have a huge impact on asset prices and a huge impact on inflation. The sort of funny thing is that academic economists are split between whether that's going to cause more inflation or less inflation. And we can kind of get into the why there, but these two trends are sort of going to dominate the next 20 years in the same way that they've dominated the last 20 years. But they're slow enough that even though we might be intellectually aware of them, it's not something that the average person spends a lot of time thinking about.
That's a really good synopsis. You talk about inflation. I think it's important to understand. We talked about this offline a bit too, but like, for people that might not be studying the fundamentals of how this system works, right? If you don't know the rules of the system, it's kind of hard to win. Can you explain, like, where did this hyperinflation come from, and like, what's the underlying flaw in the system that's creating these crises?
Well, we're not in a period of hyperinflation yet. Some economies are, but the United States and Europe are.
We're not Argentina
yet. We're not Argentina.
Yeah.
Although Argentina's actually going in the right direction right now.
With Milei, yeah.
Which is really fascinating to watch. Mm-hmm. What's caused this is basically the huge gap between government spending and government tax receipts. So we print money every year, which increases liquidity, which lowers the value of the dollar and pushes asset prices up. But done in a very slow way so that people don't entirely realize, you know, exactly what's happening. Like if I came to you and was like, okay, what's real inflation since the year 2004? My guess is that you'd probably be off by an order of magnitude. Now, because we've had this conversation, I've like loaded you for the question, probably not. But like, if you go up to the average person on the street and you're like, hey, what is a dollar in 2004 worth today in 2024? I think the average person probably tells you like 80 cents, 90 cents.
What is the correct answer?
It's less than 50.
Wow. So it's been debased 50% in the last 20 years.
Across most assets. That's wild. That's like not something. And even if you people are like, oh, it's just the last couple years. That was already down at like 70 cents before COVID. This compound of like 2 to 3% a year inflation, which the government says is 2%, but like most economists would say is more like 3 or 4. If you compound 3% inflation every year for 20 years, you're looking at some really serious numbers. But it's like I said, it's slow enough that people don't really think about it. And this is basically a tax on people with a lot of assets or people that labor in very labor cost sensitive industries.
Correct. But if you're saving money right now, let's just say you don't own any assets, you don't own crypto, you don't own real estate, and we'll assume that you're owning assets that are appreciating at a rate faster than inflation, so you're at least not getting poorer. If you're just saving money in your bank, if that same thing is true over 20 years, if you saved $1 million, that now has $500,000 worth of purchasing power. If you're just saving and don't own assets. So the people that aren't actually investing in assets and saving money are getting extra screwed.
That's correct. You know, on top of that, so this kind of like, it hits like two areas, two segments of people the hardest. Mm-hmm. I would say it hits people who are upper middle class very hard because they usually, for example, own their home and without leverage on your house. And by the way, it's not logical to most people that if they can pay off their house that they shouldn't, right? Because now they're getting their house inflated down. But it's people that own their own homes and it's people that have a lot of money set aside but are following the normal advice, the 70-30 portfolio advice of like 70% bonds, 30% equities. If you own your house that you live in and you're in a 70-30 setup, you're just getting absolutely annihilated over the last decade.
Yeah.
The other people that it hits very hard are people that are at the bottom end of the spectrum. So lower class sort of working families who don't have a mortgage. So it hits renters really hard. It sort of hits like wage labor, renters, the hardest of all. Because those people are working in industries where, you know, you're not seeing rapid pay increases that are keeping pace with inflation, but where the cost of renting is either holding constant or going up. And there's really no way out of loop for those people. They're just completely stuck there. And ironically, you're seeing most of the sort of like current political resentment emerge out of those two classes of people. Like you can look at the data and it's people who rent and people who own their own home without a mortgage that are most likely to be swinging right.
Interesting. So we have a government that is printing more money and debasing the currency and we're overspending in terms of our GDP, right? We're spending more and taking on more debt as a nation than printing money, but our productivity, our GDP is far below that. And so we're creating massive, massive deficits. And then the taxpayers are getting hit pretty hard there. When you look at that macro problem with a broken financial system like that, where it's, I feel like inflation is essentially theft, right? It's legal theft of purchasing power in some way.
I don't know if it's theft so much as a hidden tax.
Yeah, it's a sneaky hidden tax. We can be particular on the semantics, but like when you look at that problem, what do you see are the most practical solutions to this?
I mean, one is to try to get government fiscal policy back under control.
Reduce government spend.
You know, I don't know, good luck. But there's different ways to do that. Like you can increase economic growth. Yeah. So one of the things that is like fundamentally broken is that actually government debt is not necessarily a bad thing. If the economy is growing faster than our debt load, then like you can argue that the leverage is good. What's happened for the last 4 years and a lot of the last 12 years is our economic growth has only kept pace or been behind our debt growth. And so like for the last 4 years, for example, if you take out government sector and government sector league jobs, we've had negative job growth. Most economists think. And the last jobs report, it was completely clear. It was like without public sector jobs, it was negative 60,000 jobs.
Wow.
And by the way, that doesn't even include jobs that are linked to the government. Like if Accenture hires 500 people to do a government contract, that's not going to show up in those numbers.
Yeah.
But if you take out all government spending derived growth, the economy has not grown. There were long periods like in the 90s, early 2000s, where the debt was increasing our economic growth faster than the debt itself. And that's good debt.
That makes a lot of sense.
So like any financial engineering tool, they can be great, they can be terrible. Just kind of depends on the results you're getting.
How do you think about AI? Because in one sense, that's going to massively enhance our productivity and we can build a lot of value and increase our country's growth. But at the same time, when we look at like how many net new jobs are created, I imagine that's going to go down just because so much manual labor is going to be cut out and just lower level jobs that don't require high intellect and in EQ. How do you think that plays into the benefit or the lack thereof for the economy and for
over the next 20 years? I'm actually way more optimistic about the impact of AI for the US economy.
Yeah.
I'm actually more worried about how it's going to impact a lot of economies outside the United States. So if we think about it very carefully, you know, what are the jobs that have gone to Mexico, Thailand, China? There are a lot of jobs on factory assembly lines. Most of those, I think robotics, AI, like better robotics, robotics with a brain, are going to be able to handle. And the question is just like, are the robots cheaper than humans? If, you know, for example, Tesla can actually build a $30,000 robot that can clean your house, we're going to be able to build $20,000 robots that can work the floor of a Tesla factory. And if you can replace floor workers at a factory with robots, you can move a huge amount of manufacturing back from Thailand, Indonesia, China, India, so forth, back to the United States. Professional services, the jobs that I think are most likely to be replaced by AI agents are the ones that we've already outsourced to the Philippines and to India. So for example, we used to have a whole team of people that read news stories and then added them to a news feed, like six people or something. We trained a model that does that now with like one person. So like we eliminated. Now, where were those jobs? Those jobs were not in the United States. Those people were in the Philippines.
Got it. Interesting. So that could really hurt the global economy, other nations more so.
If you think about the United States, any job that could be like done without a lot of human interaction or variability, or was not that intellectually difficult, has already been moved.
Interesting. Yeah.
Like,
interesting point.
You know, there's not a lot of factory workers left in the United States, but there's a lot of people who are like plumbers, builders, you know, car mechanics, but there's no one making new cars because new cars is a repeatable process and it's not location dependent. It doesn't, you know, a car mechanic needs to be like 15 minutes from your house. Mm-hmm. You know, your factory for building your car can be wherever. And so a lot of those jobs that are going to be replaced by AI agents, whether they're sort of, you know, computer agents or whether they're robot agents, I think have already left the United States economy. In some ways, AI is actually going to be able enable us to bring a lot of, quote, jobs and more importantly, economic growth back to the United States.
Interesting.
Now, I worry a lot about what this does to a lot of like nascent democracies and economies overseas. But I'm not enough of a specialist to really understand that third impact. You can make an argument that like 50 years from now, it'll be like Star Wars and the guy working on, you know, my car is actually going to be a robot. I think we're a very long way out, but I think we're probably only 5 years out from it being a robot assembling my car in a factory, maybe less.
That's fair. You're focused, obviously you've built an amazing crypto company focus on digital assets, but I think your main mission in life is really a broader context of creating economic freedom for people and freedom in general for people, right? And like, how do you help create more sovereign people that actually can build wealth and store wealth and create lives of freedom on their own terms, you know, at scale?
Yeah. So, I mean, that's precisely right. Like, if there is a way to increase economic freedom, you know, with more leverage, better than working in crypto, I probably wouldn't be working in crypto.
Right. It's working backwards from first principles of how do I make the biggest impact towards this goal? And so when people are listening, they're like, well, I want economic freedom, man. I want to be sovereign. I want to build wealth. I want to have assets. I want to, you know, be able to build an amazing life. When you think of economic freedom, what really goes into that? Like to be a sovereign, economically free individual, what does that look like?
And this is what guides a lot of our product choices. It's about choice. you know, for me, one of the most important things that we did very early on was make it possible for sort of anyone in the world to hold their own Bitcoin directly. Sort of even more nuanced past that is we made it possible for folks to opt out of their local financial system. And so when you think about, you know, what are you doing when you buy Bitcoin or countless other assets now, you're opting out of the local financial system that you live in, whether it's the United States or some other financial system. Now, what's really interesting is now you can stay within your financial system and buy exposure to Bitcoin, like ETFs and stuff. But setting that aside, like this ability to opt out is really important. The second thing that it gave people was the ability to economically transact with people anywhere in the world. So, you know, just as easy as you can WhatsApp someone in Peru, you can send them Bitcoin and conduct trade with them. And when people have the choice to conduct trade with other people, it usually makes the world a better place. Fast forward a few years and, you know, stablecoins came along and we essentially put a US dollar checking account in, like, at the time, 30 million people's pockets around the world. Now it's a lot more people, but I thought it was the biggest, most consequential product launch we've done in a long time. It's like, here you go, checking accounts for everyone globally. That's really powerful because I may have a lot of problems with the dollar, as we've been talking about, but the dollar is still a far sight better than almost any other currency in the world. Actually, there's only one currency that's maybe better than the dollar. This is the Swiss franc. And it's tiny and no one really knows how it works. Yeah. You can't do much with it. Right. But for all the downsides of the dollar, if you're like, Peter, you can't hold crypto, you can't hold equities, you can't hold, you know, you got to hold one FX, one currency. What would I hold? Yeah, probably the dollar, which, you know, there's only 300 million people that live in America and there's 4 or 5 billion people in the world or something like that. Yeah. Right.
Do you think you'd have that same answer 50 years from now?
50 years is a long time, but probably, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think more likely than not. Yeah.
Because I think when we talk about sovereignty and people are like, hey, I wanna be sovereign. I don't wanna be controlled by a government. I wanna be able to preserve and store my wealth and not get totally screwed by inflation and work harder to get poorer. The main thing you mentioned is one, you need to be able to transact and conduct commerce with people through a peer-to-peer way without having to rely on centralized institutions that can control whether or not you can transact and dictate terms and all that kind of stuff, right? So there's the choice of who to do business with on your terms, which blockchain and crypto allows us to do. And then when people are thinking of, like, a lot of people are listening, they're like, they're not even into digital assets at all, right? They're like, well, I'm just a real estate guy, or I'm a tech guy, I'm all in my VC, or I don't even have any assets. Can you help people understand, like, why are digital currencies so important in the future of this economy? Like, what should people understand about the bigger picture of why they might look into investing into cryptocurrencies and making this part of their portfolio?
I think you kind of have to separate digital assets into two categories very broadly, and it's messy, but the two categories for me are like technology startups and then assets. And they overlap. Obviously, like a technology startup has stock, which is supposed to go up in value, often goes down. And then you have, you know, assets, which maybe are just supposed to go up or down in value, but not based on the performance of something else. It's the whole commodities versus securities thing. So, you know, for me, like, and I think it's very, the thing that makes crypto even harder to discuss is that there's really no way to, like, back it into an existing framework. And people want you to back it into an existing framework. So, like, even what I just did now, where I'm like, well, maybe the assets, maybe it's technology startups, doesn't actually really make sense in the context of crypto. But what I would generally say is that you have things like Bitcoin or digitized gold or NFTs, which are not really trying to do anything other than exist and see what price people will pay for them.
Stores of value.
Stores of value. And then you have protocols, which are enabling wider use cases. And those can also be stores of value, but they're also trying to do something beyond storing value. I'd put, you know, Ethereum in that category is the best example, which is also a commodity, which is, you know, its own fun kettle of fish. Ethereum and sort of protocols like that are really interesting because they have this option value of taking over how we transact in the world. So enabling people to buy financial products that completely live on chain. When I say live on chain, I mean there's no humans involved in their execution. Like, you can buy insurance against wheat prices via smart contract. It's very weird, but also wonderful. That's a much bigger, broader category. And so you can kind of, like, get into that why you should own crypto assets from either direction. On the maybe these protocols will do really interesting things and more and more and more in the future, I would say that you're basically investing because like you think it's the most interesting part of the technology sector today. And I would argue that outside of AI, it definitely is. Mm-hmm. And to me as an investor, and I do a fair amount of investing, AI isn't a super interesting segment to invest in because it's going to be a winner-take-all market that's almost exclusively determined by who Jensen sells compute power to.
The GPUs to.
Which, you know, probably is going to mostly be to the same three people that won the last race. So
very centralized.
Yeah. So it's a very interesting category to invest in from like a, ooh, interesting technology that might change the world perspective.
Yeah.
The store of value side is much simpler. It's like, do you think that more people in the future will think something is valuable than it is today?
Yeah, you're betting on that.
Yeah. And the most famous case, of course, is Bitcoin, which is like, you know, 10 years ago, I looked at the properties of Bitcoin and I thought, it's not 100% chance that more people think it's worth more in the future than today.
Yeah.
But there's a good chance. And if
100%.
And if you're right, the payoff is going to be huge.
How do you know what's real versus bullshit, right? People are like, all right.
I think most is bullshit.
Most is bullshit,
so
right?
You start but people, with the assumption.
People look at crypto and I think they start singling out these like meme coin projects and start grouping the whole industry into these things. And
for what it's worth, I actually love meme coins.
They're kind of fun.
They're really fun and they're also intellectually honest.
Yeah, they know.
So like no one thinks that with dog with hat, you know, it's not hiding behind a banner of like, you know, we're the fastest new protocol ever, or, you know, we're going to enable something or the other. They're just like, do you like dogs wearing hats? Yes or no?
You're worth $2 billion now.
Yeah, it's the question. The question is just like, do more people 5 years from now think it's worth more or less?
So it's essentially kind of asking yourself, like, what game are you playing,
yeah.
right? Like, are you playing like a strong thesis investment like Bitcoin? I want to store value. I'm predicting it's going to become more valuable. It could be or could not be a hedge against inflation, TBD, and correlated to stock markets. It's been up and down, but you're like, hey, over time, I think this is going to appreciate.
Yeah.
It's a good investment to hedge my portfolio with versus meme coins. You're like, all right, let's just, instead of going to the to Las Vegas, I'm just going to sit on my computer and gamble on some cool names.
Meme coins are like some weird cross between gambling and an MLM company, like a multi-level marketing company, right? Like in a religion. Like I'm not really... And different ones look more like one of the three than others. But if you think about it, like, what is a religion? Just convincing everyone that something irrational is real.
That you can't physically see.
That you can't see. It doesn't have a market price, but people that convince other people that a religion is real have been getting rich for a very long time. Like, the case in point is, like, the Vatican. You know, the Catholic Church is one of the wealthiest entities in the world today. The, you know, Mormons... They run one of the biggest hedge funds in the world.
Scientology.
God knows how much money they have.
And then meme coins.
And so, you know, like all of those religious organizations I mentioned would be quantums yeah. bigger than the biggest meme coin. The thing that's kind of new and unusual about meme coins is one, the honesty. And two, the fact that average everyday people can buy into this religious dream from day one.
Right. Interesting. Barring any sort of financial advice, obviously we're not giving any specific advice here, but when you look at crypto investing as a whole, like what sectors, protocols, coins, what are you most interested in, have, I guess, the most bullish on?
I have to admit that for the most part, like I just buy crypto and hold on to it and just hold on to the same crypto for a very long time.
What types of crypto have you?
Everything.
Just everything.
But the interesting question, like, what am I spending a lot of time thinking about right now? Mm-hmm. The Solana ecosystem.
Do you think Solana is going to overtake Ethereum?
I think it's very possible. I think it's more possible than the market would price right now. Mm. I think the market is telling you that 75% chance that Ethereum is going to be the bigger chain. I think I would say it's at best 50-50. And it might even be in Solana's favor if I were to make the line.
Very interesting.
And that just comes from the perspective as being someone who builds consumer apps. You know, like we have a huge institutional business at the company, but we also have a big retail business.
Yeah.
And I can tell you that Ethereum's scaling plan of like L2s, it's just a disaster from a consumer UX perspective. If Solana can keep pace with the growth, and so far they have this time, and they're doing more transactions and volume than ETH now.
Yeah.
Then I think it's going to be very hard to convince builders to build on, you know, Ethereum.
Yeah.
There may be one or two L2s that get a lot of traction. So
sneak up in there.
Sneak up in there.
Yeah.
But those guys will become their own L1s.
Let's talk about Bitcoin.
Sure.
I know it's impossible to give any remotely accurate prediction, but just based, you actually study charts and you think deeply about these things, right? When you look,
I don't really study charts, to be honest.
Or at least you study trends, right?
I study trends. I think charts are like religion for grown men. or what's the tweet? It's like technical analysis is astrology for men.
That's and good.
I do think you can build trading strategies around technical analysis.
Yeah.
But the only reason is because a bunch of other people believe in them.
Yeah.
So it's like if you figure out the trend first, you can make money on people following.
There's some network effect there.
There's like a network effect to it. But yeah. I do think that technical analysis is astrology for grown men.
That's hilarious. Well, yeah. when you look at Bitcoin, like where do you think Bitcoin will go in the next 10 years? What's your bull case, your bear case?
My bear case is like effectively zero. I think if Bitcoin's not demonstrably higher 10 years from now than it is today, then like it's probably dead.
With all the adoption, with all the users, like do you think that's truly possible?
Yeah.
You really do?
I'll give you an example.
How can Bitcoin,
if the US stock market is not higher 10 years from now than it is today, what's it gonna be at? Probably
is the US stock market the main thing driving the value of Bitcoin?
No, I'm just saying that things have to either get bigger or go away.
Interesting. Like do you foresee any black swans with Bitcoin? If you were to just hypothecate, whether it's quantum computing is one use case that's thrown out, or there could be several, are there any like intuitive black swans you could see happening to take out Bitcoin?
Yeah, like for example, if we find out that Satoshi is actually the Chinese government, you know, and then you have like a national security issue, or Satoshi was the US government, and then you have like a moral problem. Like Bitcoin has value because there's a bunch of people, and you know, unfortunately I'm not one of them because I was not rich when Bitcoin started, but there's a bunch of people who like have an enormous, like unfathomable amount of Bitcoin in dollar terms.
Yeah.
Who just will not sell it.
Yeah.
Because they're religious, fervent religious about it. Like I know people who own billions of dollars of Bitcoin who like still live in a normal house, drive a normal car, and fly on commercial airlines.
Why?
Because they don't want to sell their Bitcoins.
Why not sell like 10 million of your Bitcoin if you have billions? It's crazy to me. I have a friend that's just like that too.
Yeah, you can't buy like that sick of a house with $2 million after taxes. But anyways, they're just like, why would I sell my Bitcoin? Because at any other time I would have sold my Bitcoin.
That's where it does become religion to me. Because I'm like, we're talking about economic freedom, right? You want assets, you want money to live the life that you want to live, right?
By the way, I'm not in this camp.
You're not in this camp.
I'm like,
no.
I enjoy your life while you can.
Yeah.
You never really know how much time you have left, sort of camp. Not to a point of financial responsibility.
Right.
But to a point of like, look, if you die with all the money,
what's the point?
Why did you make it?
What's the point of the money?
What's the point of the money? But that's not true of a lot of the like super religious Bitcoin people.
Yeah, it's so interesting.
But my point is like, if those guys find out tomorrow that actually like Satoshi is the NSA, I can see a lot of them like
bailing out, because the whole philosophy that it was created on would then be bankrupt.
They're like rage dumping into like ether, who knows what. Like they're creating another one. I don't know.
What did you think of Michael Saylor's statement? He goes, the country that wins in the long term is the country who prints the most of their own currency and buys Bitcoin.
I think that's a hard one to pull off in practice, because it's the same thing as if a country printed a lot of their own money and bought gold. Eventually the folks buying the debt would realize that was happening. It would cause a crisis in your debt markets.
Mm.
Like from a math perspective, that's true, but you could probably never really get away with it, because you would basically start like a negative feedback loop that would be really hard to escape from once you started it.
Because the basic economics is like, hey, buy half a trillion worth of Bitcoin, buy 500 billion worth of Bitcoin, watch it appreciate 10x over the next X amount of years, and we make a big dent out of this $35 trillion debt we have.
Yes, but that would be also saying to the market, we don't think that we can finance our debt with economic growth anymore. So we're going to finance our debt with highly speculative assets.
Well, look at MicroStrategy's growth, though. I think they've got $9 billion in the actual company,
however,
and 20-something billion off of Bitcoins.
However, there's a very distinct difference with MicroStrategy, which is that you can lever their stock. So there's a lot of like carry trade leverage going on. Mm-hmm. Like that's going to be a very volatile stock. that would be the problem with pursuing that strategy, is you'd basically be going to the market and being like, we no longer believe that we can finance our debt load with economic growth.
Yeah.
Because by the way, that's what countries are supposed to be borrowing for. What I told you before, like there's good debt, bad debt.
Right.
It's supposed to be like, you know, Canada is going to the debt market and being like, if you give us $100 today, we can give you 110 in the future because we're going to generate 130 of economic growth.
Exactly.
Right.
You're borrowing to create more value. Exactly.
Same thing when you borrow to build a company.
And you have the arbitrage on that. Yeah.
So if you're going out and you're saying we're going to borrow to buy like a 90 DVOL asset, that's probably not a good look.
That's an interesting point. Are you at all afraid of central banking digital currencies? Like, do you think the government's going to pull off where they have their own Bitcoin network or blockchain and everyone is using some sort of centralized digital currency?
No, not really, because I think the government's pretty bad at technology. Like, I've never seen them do a good job of it. So, yeah.
But what if they force?
I'm like, actually more worried about, like, for example, quasi-government CBDC. So, you know, like if JP Morgan buys Circle, I think that's actually a lot. Or JP Morgan launches a stablecoin or something where... I think that's more concerning.
Interesting. Yeah, there's so many different things here. But in general, when you're talking to people that want to build, that want to create economic freedom, do you advise people to get into crypto? Is that something like a key piece of advice you give people? Or
yeah, I think if you're a young technology entrepreneur that cares about economic freedom, that cares about doing things that make, that cares about using technology to create more freedom for people, there's probably no other market that you can work in that achieves that. Because at the end of the day, like, for example, if you work in AI, the sad thing is, and there's a lot of good things about AI, but the sad thing about AI and machine learning is that it's made government surveillance much easier.
Mm.
And just surveillance generally much easier.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it used to be that if you wanted cameras that, security cameras that, like, watched everyone around your house, you're looking at a full-time team of people to watch all those cameras. Very expensive. Now there's AIs that do it for $25 a month. If you work in the AI space, it's going to make people less free. Arguably, if you work in the self-driving space, it's going to make people less free because eventually they're not going to let humans drive and you're going to have to ask the computer for permission to go places.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. And they'll do it under the guise of vehicle safety. But like eventually that's going to make humans less free. Everything on social media makes humans. So there's really, it's really hard to think of anything you can work on in technology that's going to increase human freedom.
That's very interesting. I mean, it's funny because now at this point in time, I think whether not everyone's a believer in crypto yet, but it's, I think you're sleeping if you're not seeing what's happening to some extent. It's you know, at this exact moment, it's not the hottest thing in the world. I think the bull market coming around the corner will excite people again, but it's been a lot hotter, right? Crypto is here to stay. But when you launched the company, I think in, you mentioned earlier, I think 2011, you started getting into crypto, but you like officially launched the institution and went all in on this in 2015. But you were building this at a time where it just wasn't cool. It wasn't the zeitgeist at the time, right?
And even when we went really hard, like started to go really hard on it in 2014.
Yeah.
It was still only cool in like very small corners of tech.
Well, what did you see that had you go all in on this? Like what made you make that bet?
People were using it. There were enough people using it that I was like, oh, wow. Like maybe you could build a real company here. And the other reality was that it was a very easy bet to make because I knew how to program. Mm. And so like, it's like, if this doesn't go anywhere, I'll just, you know, get a job again.
Yeah. You'll just go back and get a job.
You know, it's like,
what was the big, like first, like aha moment where you're like, oh shit, we have something big here.
Ironically, when the first meeting between Bitcoin companies, cause there was no crypto back then, Bitcoin companies and the US government was organized, like a conference. It was organized by, I think it was Thomson Reuters, which is really weird. And they had it at the National Institute of Peace in DC. And it was like crypto companies, and there were only four of us, and the Bitcoin Foundation, and then like every three-letter agency of the United States government. And they all turned up. And I was like, well, shit. Like, people are watching now. Like, people care. Like, And then, you know, tens of thousands of people were logging in at the time, and VCs were finally investing in the space. Mm-hmm. I was like, wow, this might be real. And there was a conference right before that called, it was like the Bitcoin conference. It was done by the Bitcoin Foundation, which ceased to exist after that a few years. And now it would be a really small crypto conference. Like people would be like, wow, what a fail.
Mm.
But at the time it was like an overwhelmingly big number of people. And seeing all those people in real life, you know, people like made real boosts for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, oh wow, like this is gonna be something real. But I don't know if there was ever a single moment where I was like, oh yeah, like going all in on this financially is a good idea. I just,
you never,
I don't think I ever really cared about, I've never really optimized my life around making money. And so I don't think it was ever something that was at the top of my life, top of my mind.
What was driving you?
I wanted to work on interesting stuff with really cool people and hopefully like make the world a better place, which all sounds very naive and optimistic, but yeah, really how I thought about it.
That's cool. I don't know how many cycles you've seen now.
All of them.
Of just insane volatility, dude. Like every market is volatile to some extent, but nothing like crypto that I've seen. The highs and the lows are so dramatic. Like for you, what was it like running a company as CEO through those cycles? Like what was that experience like?
It's actually one of the things that I'm most grateful for about my job is that it's really given me the opportunity to learn and grow personally in a way that very few other jobs would. Mm. I think if you know, if you want to have a lot of personal growth, like be a tech founder and, you know, hopefully your company goes somewhere and it'll really push you. Mm-hmm. Being a crypto founder will really push you.
You'll really figure out who you are.
Because the normal, yeah, the normal story arc of a tech company is like, no one cares. A few people care. And if you're really successful, suddenly people care. Crypto is really funny because you actually get to do that cycle like over and over again.
Every couple of years.
Every couple of years. Yeah. So I tell people there's like, you know, there's one year where everyone thinks you're an absolute genius. You know, everybody wants to be your friend. You know, you're like making, you know, the who's rich chart every other day or whatever. And then the next year, everyone thinks you're a complete moron because like, you know, you've written this thing down 90%.
What a scammer. You know? Yeah.
No one's ever said I was a scammer, but like people are like, oh my God, like, why didn't you sell the company? Why didn't you go public? Why didn't you do this? Why didn't you blah, blah, blah.
It's so up and down. Yeah.
And then the next year, no one cares about you. Mm. They're like, oh, like surely they've, you know, cease to exist or irrelevant. And then there's like another year where people like start to be a little interested again, which is the year we're in right now.
What allows you to ride those waves and stay in this seat for a decade now? Like, what is it mentally inside of you that allows you to stay in that position, getting your, you know, being praised like a king and getting your ass beat every couple of years? Like, what is it mentally that allows you to thrive in that?
I think a couple things. The first is that when you've done it a few times, it all gets a little like less dramatic. Mm. So when you've like watched, you know, things go up 500% in a year or 1,000% in a year and then down and then up, like the next time around doesn't feel as wild.
What was the darkest moment building blockchain.com?
The first one, because the first crash.
What was that like? Walk me through what that was like.
And the reason it was darker, and everybody thinks it's actually the most recent one. Mm-hmm. Actually, the least bad one was the middle one, the mm-hmm. second one. This last one was really bad because it caused like a crisis of faith almost. Not because our company was going anywhere, but because so many other companies like blew out and hurt so many consumers.
Yeah.
I was talking to another crypto founder, another very famous one, and we were talking about it and we were like, have we actually created something bad because of, you know, it enabled some of these bad actors. Mm. And we can talk more about that in a minute. But the reason the first one was the darkest one for me personally was that we'd never seen the market come back before. Right. So now like this one, it's like, okay, like all we have to do is like, hold on long enough and it's probably going to come back because it came back in the past. But in most tech verticals, when something dies or when something goes down a lot, it stays down and never comes back. Mm. It's kind of weird that it comes back every 3 years. The first time we didn't know what was going to happen. And you're just sitting there sort of being like, should we stop? Should we pivot to private blockchains? Return investor capital and go home?
Was there a moment where you were afraid that it was all over?
There was no single moment because it wasn't like there was like, oh, like boom. And we were like, shit, it's done. It was just like slow fade.
Slowly just getting beaten down and just like, where just is like, the light?
It's like, yeah, everybody stops using your product. You know, your investors don't call you anymore. Like, you know.
So what do you do in that situation? That's a great learning moment when the shit just hits the fan for all CEOs. Because everyone goes through it at some point at some degree of scale.
Yeah.
You got like a full on Mike Tyson left hook to the face, right? Like when you're in that situation with your team and you're losing customers, you're churning like crazy, the market's losing faith in you. What do you do? How do you keep the team together? How do you march forward?
I think that's where you have to come back to like the mission that you were there for. And so if you're there to increase human economic freedom, it doesn't really matter if you're doing that for 100,000 people or 100 million people. The 100,000 people still matter. Mm. And so you have to stay very mission-centric. And it does definitely separate out the missionaries from the mercenaries at that point. You're like, who's here for the mission and who's here for getting rich quick? You know pretty quickly. I think the other thing is, like, I just refuse to believe that people wouldn't see the value of this. Like, to me, at the time, it looked like everything got too hot too fast and then had its normal correction. And I think I had a bit of an advantage, and it was one of the reasons that we stuck with it instead of pivoting to, like, DLT or, you know, enterprise blockchain, was because I'd studied a lot of economic history, and I knew that new financial markets, particularly frontier markets, which crypto was and still is, are extremely volatile and blow up and come back frequently. And you can look at that even in the early iterations of the US stock market. So I had a little bit more economic history to, like, help guide me than maybe a lot of the folks on the West Coast.
So that gave you a little bit of peace. Yeah. You had optimism still. What did you learn? You mentioned, because, like, I think a great thing about business, it is the best personal development vehicle, right? It's almost like a spiritual evolution. Like, the more pressure you put yourself in, the more you discover things about yourself and get more in touch with your deepest nature. When you reflect back on a decade now building this company into a juggernaut, what have you learned about yourself? Like, what realizations have you had? How have you grown?
A lot.
What comes to mind for you?
Have learned the most, you know, maybe the last year or two, is actually a really good piece of advice that I got from a friend, mentor of mine, a guy named Justin Kahn, one of the Twitch founders, who's really great source of advice. And, you know, when things were difficult, you know, in the period where, like, FTX was blowing up and Celsius and Grayscale, and, you know, we had, like, you know, 8 of our top trading counterparties go bankrupt in 6 months. And those aren't customers. Those are trading counterparties where we're hedging risk and trading swaps back and forth. You know, this whole space was contracting. We did a big layoff. Same, and it wasn't coordinated, but same day, Coinbase did a giant layoff. And, like, you know, it was just bad in the crypto space. And I was talking to him, and he was like, you know, he's like, you need to be a lot more attached to the process than the outcome, because you don't control the outcome. You know, like, you don't know when Russia's going to invade Ukraine, or, you know, you never know. Like, there could be a nuclear war in the next 6 months and all of our startups fail. We didn't, like, I didn't do anything to make a nuclear war happen. Just it all failed. Now, I don't think we're going to have a nuclear war. I hope we don't, but hypothetically. So he's like, so you either need to be, you need to be attached to the process of building this company, or, like, just stop, because you can't control the outcome. And the more you obsess about the outcome, the, like, the less fun you're going to have day to day, less fulfillment you'll find. I really started to shift my mindset from, like, how do I do X to achieve Y, to what do I actually want to do all day that will bring me a lot of joy and a lot of fulfillment?
Regardless of the outcome.
Regardless of the outcome. And that changed my relationship with work a lot. The other thing that I learned is that I actually am probably too patient with people. And I'm a very intense boss, and there, you can read about that on the internet. But, like, I'm reluctant to give up on people. So I'm very willing to be very intense and drive people really hard and, you know, try to push to get the best out of them.
Yeah.
But I'm really, really reluctant to give up on people. And actually, as an entrepreneur, you need to give up on people quickly.
I can share that with you. I feel like there's three things I look at when I'm looking at the team, right? Effort, attitude, and results. And if you're getting results, awesome. Let's keep flying. But if you're not getting the results we need, like, do you have the effort? Do you have the attitude? And for the people that do have those two, I'm inclined to work with them as long as humanly possible, because I'm like, they're still adding to the culture. They're trying so hard, even if they're not the right person for that role. And, like, that, I think, might be the hardest part of being a founder.
It's really hard to fire people who are putting in the effort.
Yeah, that you love. You build deep
even
connections.
Even if the attitude and results aren't there, if they're putting in the effort, it's really hard. If the attitude and results are there, it's hard. One of my board members was like, he's like, oh, I've been working for 30 years. Like, I've never fired anyone too quickly. And there's, like, something very true about that. Like, when you look back on all the people that you've had to terminate, it's probably hard to find one that you'd fired too quickly. But there's a lot, for me personally, that I was too slowly. So there's that I've learned about myself, which is very unexpected, because I am a very intense boss. The other thing I learned is that I'm very bad at having lines between myself and how much I'll work. I get bored very easily, and I find work very interesting. So, you know, I'll like end a vacation early because I'm bored and I just want to work. But at the same time, it's probably not very healthy for my mental capacity to work too much.
You don't recharge enough.
I don't recharge enough. So I actually tracked it, and like the more time that I took off in the last year, the stronger my performance was at work, arguably, or the stronger the company's performance was. Before anyone gets like amazing ideas that I'm working every other week or something, my big life changes is that I took a 10-day vacation and I don't work on Sundays anymore. I haven't like started on the 3-day work week yet. But it turns out that I do need to take one day a week off of work.
Yeah.
And I actually leave my work phone in the house that day. And it turns out that it does help me to take like 10-day breaks from work.
Yeah.
And I think it takes about that long to really get a break from work because I need 3 days to shut the computer down, you know, and then 2 or 3 days to like turn it back on at the end of the vacation.
Yeah.
So that's been a surprising discovery is like, actually it doesn't help to be working 24/7, 365.
Yeah. I think that's a hard reality. A lot of us have to learn at some point. Like I don't think there's anything wrong with quote unquote hustle porn. I think you got to work your face off to build something, but I don't think we talk about the recovery piece as much. Like when you're an athlete, the recovery is just as important as the practice where all the growth happens.
Yeah. I think also people, you know, like I did work an enormous amount when the company was smaller. I don't think it would be possible to build a company without doing that.
Yeah.
As a young person who doesn't know what they're doing.
Yeah.
Maybe now it would be because I know what I'm doing more, but at the time it wouldn't have been. But you do see a lot of this hustle porn of like, you know, like waking up at 4 a.m., jumping into a freezing lake. And I'm just like, I know a lot of really rich, successful people. I don't know anybody doing any of that. And so I'm just like, I'm not sure how much.
You're like, no, they actually just do the work.
Yeah, they just wake up and work.
They just wake up and do the work. Yeah. For you, you know, as you're building some tips for other entrepreneurs, executives, just people that are ambitious, that are in that same lane where they're working their faces off, but like having some sort of balance where you're actually living a personal, fulfilling life at the same time and like regulating yourself. Is there anything that you've discovered, a habit or a routine, something in the last couple of years that you really wish you had started sooner?
Yeah, I wake up at 4 a.m. and I jump in an ice bucket. No. And for the record, I actually do love saunas and cold plunges.
Yeah.
I just love making fun of people who wake up early in the morning and do it.
Yeah.
A couple of things that I've found that help me a lot is that I have two phones. I have a work phone and I have a personal / fun phone. And that helps me keep my life separated.
Mm.
It actually helps me focus better when I'm at work because I'm not like getting messages from the boys when I'm, you know, on a Zoom. Well, I am. I just don't know that I am. And it helps me when I'm hanging out socially because I can leave that work phone behind. And obviously, you know, my EA has my number. Some of the other execs have my personal number. So if there's an emergency, someone will find me. But most of the things that are coming in on your work phone that even you think are emergencies are not. Like if you didn't find out about them for 2 or 3 days, nothing would happen. And in my case, I'm just checking my messages at the end of the day on Sundays. So having two phones, keeping that very separated actually has been really great for me. The other thing I would say is having a fair number of weeks a year where you don't set an alarm is really important for most human beings.
Say more about that.
I think that like alarms are pretty disruptive to people's sleep cycles. And there's ways you can get around that, like, you know, good morning lamps and shit. But at the end of the day, like, it's really nice to have a bunch of weeks every year where you just, like, sleep when you want to go to bed and you wake up when you want to wake up. And particularly if you've been pretty successful in life, to me, it's really sad, these people that are very successful, and it's like, no, I need to wake up at 5 a.m. I need to be on my first call at 7 a.m. I'm going to be scheduled until 4 p.m., then I'm going to do a work dinner at night. And I'm like, this is a weird version of what you want to do with your life when you're really successful. Like I know a billionaire who, one of the richest people in the world, who has two private jets, you know, the matching ones because, you know, they go in maintenance. And he was telling me how many nights a year he ends up sleeping on the jet. And it was something like, it was like almost 2 months a year sleeping on the plane. And this dude, he had more money than all you could ever spend in a lifetime. And I was sitting there, I was like, man, if I was as even 10% as successful as you, you wouldn't catch me sleeping 2 weeks a year on a jet, even if it was my own jet. Because like, you're still getting terrible sleep on that plane. Not terrible, but like, it's not ideal. And the bigger point is like, why are you still like running around the world at hyperspeed? It just doesn't make sense to me. And so I think like one of the biggest luxuries in life is having the ability to decide what you want to do when you do it. Like, you know, this morning I actually woke up really early, no alarm, but I got tired early last night, went to bed at like 10 p.m., ended up waking up at 6. Didn't have anything scheduled till 10. I decided I wanted to work. But like getting to make that choice, getting to decide when you wake up in the morning, it's really nice. And I think people don't prioritize that enough.
Mm, I completely agree. I think, yeah, I have a buddy who used to sleep 4 hours a night, work probably 18 hours a day for the first 3 years of building his company. And, you know, took it to many billions. And now I was like, man, I really love getting 6 hours of sleep a night. I'm like, at least you're making some progress. But I think it's interesting because we want to hustle, we want to maximize productivity, but we don't look at the downside benefit of just our cognitive and physical performances when we totally neglect ourselves. And I definitely was in that 100-hour week grind for a while. And I'm with you too. Like, I can't imagine being a billionaire and still driving at that same pace. It's like Naval Ravikant, right? He's like, the whole purpose of playing a game is to become free from it.
Mm-hmm.
And this ties into your perspective of economic freedom. If you're so warped into this idea that you need to just accumulate infinite resources, you're essentially imprisoned in the business game for the rest of your life. You have the agency to choose what to do, but you are driven by some sort of subconscious program or insecurity or something that's keeping you trapped inside this cycle. Maybe you really just love the game, maybe, but I would probably argue that there's something deeper that's imprisoning you into that pattern, into that cycle.
And it's super easy because like there'll always be someone richer than you, you know, as it turns out. Unless you're like Elon Musk right now.
Yeah.
But you know, to be fair, just because we don't know about them, there are probably families that are richer than Elon Musk.
Definitely.
Right? And more liquid. Which when you get to some level of wealth, it's not really your net worth you think about, it's your liquidity, something they don't tell you when you're younger. But like this stuff just becomes an endless chase. You know, and it's like, okay, now you have 3 houses, now you have 4 houses, 5 houses. Like you can't really use them all.
Mm.
Like it just becomes sort of an endless cycle of things you have to take care of and things you have to do. When it turns out like the things that made me happiest in life, getting to decide when I wake up, what I do for most of the day, and a dog. Like I would venture that for most people, not a nightmare dog, but a good dog will bring more happiness to their life than almost any other luxury item.
Isn't it funny that a lot of the things after we've had success and built wealth, the things that we end up investing most of our time into are the things that we had access to without any money at all?
Yeah. Although my dog seems to be pretty expensive.
He likes the organic
but,
foods.
But the only reason that the dog is expensive is because I'm still working so much.
Think about it though. Let's just say you make 100 grand, 200 grand a year. You can virtually do a lot of the same things that bring the meat of the joy in life. You can have dinners with friends. You can have a great relationship. You can have a dog. I was at a guy, you know, worth decabillions house many years ago and stayed with him for a few weeks. And every single night, all we did was play board games on the beach. Yeah. And I got in my head, I was like, what is one of the richest people in the world do? And I'm like, they do the same shit that I do. They just, you know, they're doing it on a beach, but there's not much difference. And that got me to really think about wealth differently. It's like, no, it's the agency to spend your time doing the things that truly fulfill you. And then using your money as a means to facilitate those things versus being a slave to the money.
And there's different people that like, it also depends like how much agency you want. Because for example, like you might want the money to have the agency to change the world or influence politics.
Very true.
For me, I'm good. I don't want that agency. And I would frankly just view it as like another fucking thing that I had to do if I had it. So for me, like the big change in life was when I could just buy anything, plane tickets, you know, dinners, food, whatever I wanted without really thinking about it.
Yeah.
And to me, like, you know, that happened a while ago and obviously still can do that. But like, there hasn't been a big change as I've gone up or down wealth bracket since then.
See, I got one final question for you, a hypothetical question. Have you seen Men in Black?
Yes.
Okay. This is an interesting one. Do you remember that pen they use to wipe people's memory?
Yes.
The deneuralizer?
Yeah.
So if you imagine you're about to get deneuralized right now. And your memory is about to just get wiped clean. And before that happens, you get to write down one piece of advice to yourself that you can carry into your next life with your brand new slate. But you get one thing that you can write down to give yourself some sort of advice or guidance that you want to take into that. What would you write down?
Well, just to be very technical, do I still have all the same assets on the other side of this?
But you threw me for a loop there now.
Because
do I let you keep your assets?
Because it's interesting. Like, do I need to give myself advice about how to live a great life? or advice about how to make money?
Let's do both.
So advice about how to live a great life would be like, spend at least an afternoon a month, totally unattached, thinking about your life. I think if you want to have a really high quality life, you just need to spend 4 to 6 hours just not on your phone, not watching TV, just out in nature, ideally, thinking about where you're at in life and what's going on in your life. Because anything that's not right in your life will bubble up to the surface. And anything that you really want to be doing that you're not doing will bubble up to the surface. Like, you will just live a much higher quality of life if you just spend a few hours every single month just in contemplation in nature. If I need to make money again, I think the thing that I would tell myself is like, go find the three smartest people you know that haven't made money yet and figure out something to do with them.
That is fucking great advice, man. I love that. Those are great. One of them, the contemplation, I totally agree. The self-reflection is, you know, the Stoics understood that. I feel like it's been lost in today's society because we're so fast-paced. On the money one, that's interesting. Go find the three smartest people and just figure out something to do with them.
I think it's a numbers game. Like, if you find three really smart people, you're probably going to only end up working with one or two. And at the end of the day, like, I'm pretty smart, sure if I, like, paired up with the two other smartest available entrepreneurial type people I know right now, we could make money in, like, the pet food market or, like, the electricity market. They really wouldn't. And as an investor, I don't actually believe in the, like, specialist philosophy that, like, okay, we should, like, invest in an entrepreneur in this market segment because they worked in this market segment for a big corporate. I think there's a lot of upsides to knowing a market and a lot of downsides to knowing a market. Like, if you come in and you have no idea how building boats works, you might build boats from first principles and do a much better job of building boats.
Like Elon.
I also, like, think that if you're a master boat craftsman who's worked at another boatyard for 20 years and you want to build a boat company in a better way and you can tell me how you're going to do it differently, that might even be a better investment. Like, imagine, like, the lead, if there was such a thing, but like the number one NASA engineer wanted to leave NASA and be like, I want to do it all differently because I've learned all the bad ways to do it. Probably a great guy to back, right? But at the same time, it could be the NASA engineer, like the CEO of NASA. He leaves NASA. I probably don't want to invest in him because it clearly hasn't been going well. So, you know, it can just really depend. Yeah. But I think if you get really smart people who have a lot of drive, it doesn't really matter what market they go into, they'll probably make money.
That's really good. I haven't even heard that piece of advice. Usually it's like, oh, let's go find a problem, go create value. I like that. Find a few smartest people you know and go figure out something to do with them.
Because the problem that you pick is going to be based around who those people are.
Definitely.
Like, for example, if the three guys that are available at the time are all brilliant salespeople, I probably would build like a consulting and services business because those scale really quickly with great salespeople and you can flip them and sell them really quickly. If the people I know who are free at the time are like world-class technology leaders, I'm probably building a different company. And so it's really, to me, at the end of the day, it's all about the available team.
Dude, I love that. That's one of the best pieces of advice I've heard. Well, dude, this has been very fun, very insightful. Thanks for coming on, man.
Thanks for having me.